What happens to youth who end up in Canada's child protection system? That's something filmmaker André Casabon is exploring in her newest documentary series, Six Within. It's just one of the many films André has made about youth at risk since she ended up living on the streets as a young teenager. André is speaking at the Fraser Valley Criminal Justice Conference, but first she joins us on the line from Ottawa. Hello, André.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
So can you just tell us a bit about the youth who you filmed for this series of documentaries about youth in care and protection?
Yes. Well, in fact, the series is a few documentaries that deal with different issues around child welfare. And two of the films from that series are about to be released this year. These are not films that I will be showing in Abbotsford, mind you, but they are two of my recent film. One is a documentary called Family on the Edge, and it follows a father who finds himself in a homeless shelter with his two children. And it's his quest to hang on to his kids so that they don't fall into foster care and hopefully find a home before Christmas. So I actually filmed with the children and the father for two Christmases in a row, and that's the making for Family on the Edge. And more recently, I've just finished Third World Canada, which looks at First Nation children in care in Canada. And I'm not sure if you know this, but there's actually more children in foster care today than there ever was at the height of the residential school. And so the film follows a family of eight children, eight brothers and sisters who are orphaned from suicide and the third world conditions that exist on reserves that make child welfare rather challenging. So those are my two recent films.
And what was it like following the children who are in foster care? What happens to them? I mean, you said there are eight brothers and sisters. Are they able to even stay together while in foster care?
Well, in Third World Canada, the documentary follows the aftermath of the suicide of the parents. And the youth that I focus on the most is one of the older sister, who's a 15-year-old, and the two brothers who were actually witness to the suicide. So they were 5 and 6 at the time they lost their father to suicide. And the film looks at how a community is supposed to deal with wrapping their arms around eight children who are traumatized and recently orphaned by suicide in the context of the third world conditions on reserve. So in the context of my community here in Ottawa, when children come into care, they automatically can stay in the community and have access to services. But in a third world reserve, the reality is very different. In the community that I filmed in, which is called Kitchinemakusib in Inuwig, or KI for short, for example, there's 300 people on a wait list in a small community for housing. So all of a sudden, when you're trying to keep a sibling group of brothers and sisters together in a community that's already diminished below capacity, it is unbelievably challenging. And I must say, as a non-Aboriginal person witnessing this for a year and a half that I filmed in the community, I was deeply, deeply embarrassed about my own heritage and what we are doing to Aboriginal people. So hopefully viewers will see Third World Canada, and although it is a sad and tragic story, it's also a call for us to join the reconciliation movement and look at ways to put an end to the third world conditions on reserve, because certainly the film shows the point of view of children left to deal with so much in a community that has so little.
Can you tell us a bit about what those kids do did go through in the aftermath, and if they kind of make it out together.
Yes, well, I mean, it's hard to speak on behalf of all of the children in the story, but certainly one of the things that's remarkable about that family is that even though they're divided by distance, they continue to have such a strong bond and care and concern for each other. Following the funeral of the mother, who was the last parent to die of suicide, her sister stepped forward and took home with her, she had her own two children, and then she took an extra five of the group of sibling of her nieces and nephews, and she left behind three. So the family did step forward. The grandparents, who live in the senior home, took two of the children, and only one of them went into foster care at the time. But you know, one of the things that's remarkable is the amazing power of community that can be found on our First Nations Reserve. And certainly, I don't think I've ever heard of a single mother putting herself through university on, you know, living poverty level, taking on an extra five children without any additional resources to do that. You know, as she talks about in the film, she didn't even have mattresses for all the children. So by the time filming was done, some of the children were still in the community, and others were kind of scattered throughout the region and the province. And to this day, you know, in a community that when you have a two-bedroom home, you're already overcrowded as it is, because everybody comes from the family to come and stay over. So to think that you could find a caregiver to look after eight children, there's just not the capacity, the space, or the house to do that. So the kids, some of them are still, you know, still bouncing around. It's a real tragedy, what's happening in our First Nations reserves.
And you mentioned there was that one child who had to go into foster care while the others got to stay with their different family members. Just wondering how that child was affected, you know, sort of being the one who was left to go live with strangers.
Yeah, well, luckily, he got to at least stay in his community and stay in his own language and so on. But eventually, out of the eight kids, a certain number of them ended up going into foster care, some within their own community on reserve and some off reserve. You know, one of the boys in the film, for example, by the time filming was done, he had already moved 30 times. And of course, when he told me that, I just couldn't believe it, and I had to check with the agencies, and yes, he did move 30 times by the time he was 8.5 years old. So, you know, there's still such an impact to kids who are in care. And I myself, you know, spent a brief period of time in the Children's Aid Society, and I've always made films about youth at risk. And in fact, the film that I'll be presenting in Abbotsford is Letters to a Street Child, which is my own experiences on the streets and back to my community. So the issue of kids in care is something that's been really close to my heart. I've been advocating on this issue, started scholarships for youth in care. You know, I've helped in my community raise over $400,000 for youth in care scholarships. And spoke out in media and conferences and screenings at my film and film festivals. But all this time, all these years, while I was advocating on youth and care, I had no clue the severity of youth and care who are Aboriginal. You know, and here I was, you know, almost a champion for rights of kids in care. And meanwhile, I had very, very little knowledge and exposure, I must say, to the reality of the highest number of kids in care, which are Aboriginal. So in my travels, as I was making this six-part series, I started receiving invitations to visit First Nations communities and to look at the issue of child protection when you're practicing child welfare in a country that has a high standard of living, except for on reserves, where, as the film demonstrates, you know, Canada sits at the top three, the top six countries, the top nine countries to live in, depending on the year, and yet our First Nations people sit at number 47 on that same equation. So child welfare and child protection and looking after kids in care in a community that sits way, way, way below the standard of living in the rest of the country is a really unique feat. And then I was starting, as I was visiting different communities, and I've been to Kamloops, B.C., for example, learning about the impact, the generational impact of residential schools, and learning about the conditions on reserve, I felt a bit of a hypocrite, if you will, to be a youth advocate all these years and have, just like the rest of most Canadians I talk to, just have my eyes completely blinded to what's going on in my own backyard. So it's been a revelation. I've had some amazing teachers along the way, and I can't wait to launch out Third World Canada. We're looking at screening it in a tour from coast to coast. So if there's communities that are listening and are interested in inviting Third World Canada to talk about the impact on children in terms of the Third World conditions for First Nations, it would be my pleasure to visit and showcase this film so that we can all have our eyes open and join in a reconciliation movement so that children are not left behind to such a degree. So it's been an amazing journey.
I just want to go back to your own story. You mentioned that that's what you'll be talking about when you come out to Abbotsford. Just wondering if you can tell us a bit about what happened in your own experience when you were a young teenager and how you ended up sort of living on the street.
Well, Letters to a Street Child is a 25-minute film that I'll be presenting at the Abbotsford Criminal Justice Conference. And it's the film is based on the letters that my father wrote to me while I was myself addicted to drugs and on the streets. So it's a film that shows both the world of the streets and the world of the community and the family left behind. And in my story, you know, I come from a family of two teachers. My dad was actually the head of phys ed who was responsible for teaching the drug and alcohol unit. And never in a million years did my parents think that they were raising what was soon going to become an addicted street kid by the time I was 13, 14. So the film is also a bit of a different story that perhaps some of the people at the conference who are probably going there as police officers and probation officers and people who work in the court system, but probably they'll, by the time they're through watching the film, they'll start to look at this film from the eyes of a parent and the eyes of a family member, which is really my intention with telling my story. It's to it was to create a story that would hit home for people so that they could say, my God, you know what, this could be my own daughter, this could be my niece, this could be my neighbor. Addiction, the impact of sexual assault, these are things that can affect all of us. It's just a couple of variables away from a stable family to a family that's completely torn up and on the brinks of an inevitable breakup or divorce when you add in the equation of drugs and alcohol.
And did you end up having any connection to the child welfare system while you were living on the street? Did you end up in custody at all?
Mm-hmm. I was involved with I was involved with some gangs, and so the police had me on their radar, if you will. And so when I was brought back home from the streets, I was actually picked up by a police officer, and I went to a detention center. And from there, I went before a family judge, and I was placed in the care of the Children's Aid in Ontario, which is the child welfare system. And from there, I never went and stayed in a foster family, but I did a number of youth institutions, if you will, group homes, detention centers, and the likes. And so that was my coming into care, if you will, which is not necessarily the typical trajectory of some youth, and certainly, my story is one of addiction where, because of lack of addiction services, I ended up in care by default. But certainly, you know, from making films like Words of the Crown, where I followed four young people leaving the child welfare system, there are so many kids in care that never do end up on the streets and never do end up even touching drugs or alcohol. So I certainly don't want to paint a portrait of youth in care as troubled kids who end up involved with the law, but that was my story, and that's how I ended up in the care of the Children's Aid.
What do you know? How many kids in care do you end up sort of interacting with the law and with the criminal justice system?
Well, you know, one of the things that I find really sad about our child welfare system right now in Canada, there's currently about 90,000 children who call the government their parent, their caregiver, and out of that number, one of the trends that really worries me is how we are systematically introducing everyday kids. You know, these are normal kids who start off in care because of trauma, because of neglect, because of abuse. But other than that, they are your typical average kids. You know, you'll find kids in the suburbs who are also traumatized, but they don't necessarily lose their home. And what happens when children come into the care of the system is when they become teenagers, sometimes by default, sometimes by necessity, or sometimes it's just because we run out of foster homes, they end up in group homes. And in those group homes, they will be introduced to the criminal system by default.
Why is that?
And by default, I mean, for example, group homes will have laws and rules and regulations along the lines of, you know, zero tolerance for violence and property damage and abusive language, and in theory, I mean that's good. We wouldn't want them to tolerate it, but sometimes what that happens is a young person will break a lamp, just like they might break a lamp in their home in suburbia. And the police are automatically called. Or if they're more than 5 minutes late from curfew, police will be called. And so you know, in an era where restraints, physical restraints on kids are out of fashion now, we find ourselves with, you know, a lot of the staff in group homes are 21, 22, 23-year-olds who are they themselves just fresh out of high school, in college, doing child and youth care work. And there's maybe one or two of them with a group of 6 to 8, maybe boys, you know, teenage boys. And so the police will get called in almost like a super nanny type of system, you know. Instead of using the 1-2-3 timeout against the wall or on the little, you know, on the little mat, we'll use the police as the consequence. Well, you're late, we're going to have to call the police. And, you know, a parent would not do that. A parent would do something else, but you wouldn't call the police because your child is late, or you wouldn't call the police because they broke a lamp. So we're criminalizing youth in care at a really alarming rate for a lot of things that are not necessary to bring in police. And I know that police is also very concerned about this trend. And it's a bit of a hit and miss, you know. Every group home has different policies, every community has different police response. And quite frankly, I don't think that the youth justice system and the child welfare system have yet to put in place some protocols and some dialogue even on this particular topic. And so what you end up with is kids in care who by default are introduced to the criminal system, who then some of them will take on that label as a youth offender, or be put in detention maybe one night, maybe two nights, and make friendships and learn things that they probably never would have learned if they were attached to caring adults instead of being in a group home situation. And I don't mean to attack the group home system either. I mean, some of them are running some wonderful programs, but it is a hit and miss. You know, you don't know which group home you're going to end up in and what their protocol is around calling police. You know, so it's a little alarming. So yes, we do have a lot of youth in care who are introduced to the criminal system. You know, but the question begs: are they being introduced because they are the true definition of a criminal? You know, i.e., they're doing break and enters at night for kicks with friends or to steal for income, or are they being criminalized because they are growing up in a system?
What do you think needs to be changed in order to change the system to stop criminalizing youth?
Well, you know, I guess I have a bit of a different take on it. You know, the things that that I speak really strongly in terms of new directions we could be taking for youth in care are perhaps a little unconventional. And I must say, you know, I'm only a filmmaker, and so these are just my opinions. But I think that we would really do youth great justice, if I can use that word, in looking at them simply as kids. You know, all kids in care are in care because of one reason alone, and I believe that the only reason why they're in care is because there's a disconnect in a significant relationship, right? And the rest is details. You know, there's a million reasons why kids come into care. You know, and so I think it's our job to say, well, they are coming into care because of a disconnect in a relationship. So I think our job is to reconnect them to relationships. And instead of just looking at the solution as, you know, there should be better protocol and dialogue between group homes and the criminal justice, and those things are all wonderful, but really what it comes down to is, where do we want to house kids that are disconnected from primary relationships? And I think, you know, I wish for all kids in care to have a caring adult in their life that is going to show up at their graduation, is going to root for them, is going to be there when they give birth and they want to say, oh, look, it's a girl. when you've grown up in care, which of your 120 professional relationships will you've been introduced to would you call to say, oh, look, it's a girl, you know? So really, if we want to seriously decrease the criminalization of youth in care, we need to look at really, really innovative ways of connecting kids to relationship. And I think we do kids in care a really great disservice by selling them this pipe dream that we don't sell our own kids, that they can be independent at age 16, 17, 18 and raise themselves. And I know British Columbia has done some great strides in supporting young people beyond the age of 18. But I think we need to look at ways to reconnect. I was just at a conference in Tampa, Florida, where they actually have a team of investigators, and they investigate not abuse, but relationships for kids. They go and find that favorite aunt who lives one province over. They go and find that grade 2 teacher that really cared about that kid. And the hope is that they might adopt, but even if they don't adopt, they want kids to be connected to significant relationships so that those relationships can raise them into teenagers, into adults. And I think that's how we're going to greatly reduce the harm that we're doing to kids in care, the self-harm that they in turn do on themselves, and the great lack they have in learning how to be a parent, to parent the next generation of kids. So I think we, you know, services are great, but I'm really for advocating connecting kids to relationships.
Andrea, thank you so much for telling us about this and providing your unique perspective on this issue.
Well, thank you, and I look forward to the conference in Abbotsford.
Great. Have a good night.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Andre Cazabon is a filmmaker based in Ottawa. She'll be speaking at a community forum as part of the Fraser Valley Criminal Justice Conference on April 28th.